we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, May the 13th, 2016. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by our guest co-host, Beck Wonders.
Hi there.
And Darren Chang.
Hello.
Welcome, everyone. So if you've been listening to the show, you will have heard about Animal Advocacy Camp happening here in Vancouver next weekend. It's Vancouver's premier annual conference for anyone who is interested in advocating for the animals. And it's being presented by the local nonprofit Liberation BC. Animal Voices is proud to be a sponsor of the event, and Darren here is proud to be a key organizer of the conference, right?
Yep.
So we'll be speaking with Darren today to find out about this year's Animal Advocacy Camp. And we'll also be giving away a free ticket to the weekend's events as well. It's worth $60. So please stay tuned if you want to learn how to win that ticket and to find out more about the conference. And then for our feature interview, we'll have world-renowned ethologist and primatologist Franz De Waal on the show. He has recently written a book called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And in it, he discusses the human exploration of animal intelligence. In this interview, we'll speak to him about some of the findings in his book and what we can learn about the cognitive capacities of non-human animals. That interview is coming up in 33 minutes. So last weekend was a very busy weekend for animal advocacy here in Vancouver. We had the Empty the Tanks protest on Saturday morning, and then Lindsay Wolf's talk on undercover investigations in the evening, and then a protest at the farm Aldor Acres on Sunday. You can find out more about Lindsay's work by listening to our show from last week at animalvoices.org. But let's talk first about Empty the Tanks. Beck and Darren, you were both there. For those who don't know, what is Empty the Tanks and how is the protest this year?
That's right, Allison. Empty the Tanks happened last weekend, and it's part of a international protest. I think it went on in about 60 different cities. Is that right?
Yeah, internationally.
Internationally, yeah. Right. And for Vancouver, it's the fourth annual event that happened. And it's basically a protest that calls for an end for whale and cetacean and dolphin captivity, particularly also an end for the breeding programs. And I noticed a really large presence at the Vancouver Aquarium of people who want to end captivity. Also an increase in security, which was interesting. And of course, as always, the cops riding in on horses just to piss us off.
Yep.
What did you notice about the event, Darren?
I thought it was really great energy. It was nice weather, good turnout. And what's also really interesting now in recent years is, I think, on top of just calling for an end to captive breeding and end of exploiting cetaceans for entertainment, there are also more concrete goals now. A lot of activists out there, including scientists, are calling for organizations that have the resources and funds to invest in building sea pen sanctuaries where the cetaceans can retire to and live out the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I heard recently that there might be one of these whale sanctuaries starting on Vancouver Island, is
that
right?
So Vancouver Island has been proposed as one really great ideal location to at least try it out and experiment with a sea pen sanctuary. So that was really exciting.
Yeah. How was the feedback from, like, did you see people trying to go into the aquarium? Like, did you get a sense of what the feedback was like or reception was from people who were patronizing the facility?
I didn't notice that many people going in. There were a couple tourist bus tourists buses who came and brought a lot of people in, and it's hard to kind of turn around and leave when you're part of a group. But not that many people. But then also the next day was Mother's Day, so there would have probably been quite a few people coming the next day. But yeah, a lot of people did turn around and didn't buy a ticket, which was, you know, heartening to
It's very encouraging.
Yeah.
As always, you know, you put so much effort into attending this protest, and there were about 150 people there this year, right? So I know it would just make me feel really good because I showed up, that some people decided not to go in and buy a ticket.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that was really great to see was how many children were on the side of the protests. They brought a lot of energy with them.
At the protest itself.
Yeah, at the protest.
Yeah, that's always good. Mm-hmm. That's always great. I love child activists.
Yeah.
So the next day, Darren, you attended the protest that we were speaking about last week at the farm in Langley called Aldor Acres. And I heard you had some unusual experiences there. Discuss.
Yeah, for sure. A group of us, I think about 10 activists, we drove out to Langley to the Aldor Acres farm. And we wanted to protest them because, of course, it's Mother's Day. And there they are sort of hosting a Mother's Day event, inviting families to go and to play with the animals that are being exploited by the farm. And we thought it was important to bring the message to them that, you know, we should respect all mothers on Mother's Day. And of course, we're challenging their marketing, their humane washing marketing, sort of presenting their farm as treating animals really nicely and really caring for these animals, even though at the end of the day, they're making money off of slaughtering these animals. And the interesting experience was actually earlier that day, I was just out in Langley doing some leafletting about the dairy industry, again, for Mother's Day. And we bumped into this really nice couple who really supported our message. And then later on that day, just coincidentally, we saw them at Aldor Acres again, and they were there to go, you know, they brought their kid. It was a couple, and they had one kid, and they were there just to go play with the animals. But they heard our heard us chanting and speaking out on the megaphone, so they decided to approach us instead. And we had this amazing conversation where in the end we convinced them to actually go visit Happy Herd, and they did.
So awesome.
Happy Herd is a neighboring farm animal sanctuary.
Exactly. So we sent them to Happy Herd, and they said, they told us straight up, like, if there's a better place that we could take our kids to, like, we would never support this humane sort of farm.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Animal sanctuaries are relatively new. So for families who want to show their children farm animals or experience animals firsthand, they'll pick the obvious option. And these, you know, kind of semi petting zoo places are easy to find. So it's great to see that people are willing to, you know, if there's a better option, change their mind and choose a more compassionate option.
Definitely. So we ended up, David Isbister, who was one of the organizers of that protest, he brought a lot of delicious vegan food with him because, as we all know, he's amazing making great vegan food. And yeah, we shared muffins and bean salad with the couple as we were talking to them. And so that was a nice experience. Mm-hmm. The not so nice experience was that this one staff from Aldor Acres, she came out to close the gate on us, and she had this dog with her the entire time, assuming the dog is like a family dog on the farm. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of challenged her by saying, you know, telling her, like, you know, if you wouldn't kill that dog, why kill other animals, right? And what she did was just like kind of shocking to us a little bit, because she pulled out a pocket knife and immediately walked over to the dog and asked us, like, was taunting us and saying, like, do you want to see it? Do you want to see me kill this dog? And just to make a point, of course, like, we didn't think she would seriously harm that dog in any way. But
I don't know what to think of behavior like that. That's just it's just totally defensive.
Yeah, for
it's
sure.
It's defensive to the extreme. And I would really just like to try to open this person's heart to realizing what the truth is. And this person, obviously, she's got some walls up. And then you had all the tire, the air let out of your tires, right?
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting. We're just glad they didn't slash any of our tires, and they were just
they
like
just
letting
the
air out.
Well, and it's kind of bizarre because clearly they weren't enjoying your message or your presence there. So letting out the air in your tires is kind of counterintuitive if they want to get rid of you.
Exactly.
Good point, Beth. Good point. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that.
All right. There's still time to let your voice be heard for Bill C-246. This bill proposes to amend the criminal code to consolidate and modernize various offenses against animals in Canada. Issues pertaining to shark finning, the selling and labeling of dog and cat fur, issues around puppy mills, and a lot more. It's essentially a bill that is going to take Canada's very antiquated status around animal welfare and modernize it. So you can email your MP. If you don't know who your MP is, look it up online. It's super easy. And follow up with a phone call. You still have time during May to do this. There's also an event tomorrow called Break Free Vancouver. It's May 14th from 10 to 5 p.m. And essentially, it's an event that takes a stance against fossil fuels in Vancouver and advocates for a fossil fuel-free future. Try saying that four times in a row.
I like the alliteration
we're going to meet at Kate's Park in North Van and paddle over to Marine West Terminal at the Kinder Morgan facility. That's for the kayaktivists. And for the people who are going to stay on the ground, meeting at 11 a.m. at Westridge Park, 320 Cliff Avenue in Burnaby. Then on May 15th, on Sunday, there's the International Earthlings Experience. Some of you may be familiar with the documentary film Earthlings. It's essentially a film which shows the various ways in which animals are used in our society. And we're meeting at 4 p.m. on Sunday the 15th at the Art Gallery to expose this film to the general public.
And lastly this week, we have an event on Monday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Orr Gallery. Dr. Elizabeth Ormandy and I will be giving a presentation on the human governance of animal use at universities, and we will be taking a critical look at the work of Dr. Laura Genera, who we actually interviewed on the show before.
I remember that.
On her paper, yeah, that critiques the way that animal use is monitored and reviewed and governed at university level. So if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food, food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
So for our first interview today, we're speaking with our guest co-host, Darren Chang, who also happens to be the key organizer of this year's Animal Advocacy Camp, Vancouver's premier animal advocacy conference happening on May 21st and 22nd and presented by the local nonprofit organization Liberation BC, of which Darren is a director. Vancouver Animal Advocacy Camp aims to strengthen the animal advocacy movement by building empowered and passionate communities of activists to end injustices perpetrated against all animals. Darren is here today to tell us about this year's conference and what to expect for those who can attend. So thanks for joining us today, Darren, to speak about this.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so this year is the fifth almost annual conference here in Vancouver. In the past, it's been touted as an unconference, but the format has changed this year. So what was the unconference format all about, and how is AAC different for this year?
In the past, we've done the on-conference format where we would only have a few keynote speakers, but for the vast majority of the conference, it was really the attendees who were participating in the conference who got to set their own topics for discussions and create their own workshops. And people had the freedom to choose, you know, which discussion or workshop they would like to attend. So it was very much an attendee-led type of event. So we've done that for 4 years in a row, from 2000 to 2010 to 2014. But we've received feedback from past conference attendees that they would like to see something that is more structured, with, you know, speakers and panels to share their experiences and knowledge more. So we've decided to take that into account and give this a try, to just try a different format and do a more formally structured conference, where we did invite various speakers and activists who have done a lot of work for animal advocacy to the conference to speak.
Switch it up a little, right?
Yep.
So there's so many exciting speakers attending this year. One of the ones I'm most excited for is Lauren Ornelas, and her I've already heard speak, so that kind of shows her ability as a lecturer and speaker. Who are some of the speakers that you're excited about, and what are they going to talk about?
I'm really excited for Manisha Dekka's talk, and that's because, you know, I'm kind of interested in the more theoretical aspects of animal advocacy as well. And so for those who don't know, Manisha Dekka is an animal studies scholar at the University of Victoria in their Faculty of Law. So she is a critical legal scholar, and she's giving a talk to basically discuss some of the recent legal advocacy for animals in the United States and internationally as well, and how the current strategies might not be the best way to advocate for animals in the long run. So a good example is the Non-Human Rights Project that is currently pushing to have personhood recognized by the court and the government in the United States for cetaceans and primates, particularly chimpanzees and whales. But I think Manisha Dekka's perspective is that, you know, when we're doing legal advocacy for non-human animals, we shouldn't distinguish based on species capacities, at least the capacities that, you know, that we that appear more human-like to us. So talks like that, yeah, I'm really excited for it.
And it's so cool what these conferences do, because they really bring together local speakers who you may not necessarily have heard of, and then all of a sudden they come together and you realize what amazing work is being done. Can you mention another local speaker who will be attending?
Yes, one local speaker I'm also really excited about is Elizabeth Ormandy, who is the founder and director of a new initiative called the Animals in Science Policy Institute. And their goal is to start changing the culture of science education at the high school level and grade school level by advocating for the use of non-animal alternatives, so use of technology to replace the use of animals in classroom dissections, for example. And that is something that is just really practical. And again, that's why I'm really excited about the diversity of topics and speakers in this conference, because, like I mentioned, we have someone like Manisha, who is really more on the theoretical side of things. And then we have Elizabeth Ormandy, who is out, you know, on the ground doing grassroots, you know, engagement with high school teachers and really trying to change things in the short term.
Yeah, speaking of diversity of topics, the one that I'm really looking forward to is the one that Mark Hawthorne is presented, and he's totally not local either, so it's very diverse range of speakers, and we have some speakers coming from Ontario as well. He's doing a talk on compassion fatigue, avoiding activist burnout. Can you say a few words about that?
Yeah, I think that is just such an important topic to cover, because activism is tough work, both emotionally, mentally, and physically, and it's been, I think for Mark, this has been a topic that's been really dear to his heart, because he sees activists burning themselves out in all sorts of situations during his time as an activist. So he's basically going to offer some very practical, suggestions and tips on things that activists can do to practice good self-care, take care of ourselves, and sustain our activism and not burn out. So I'm really looking forward to learning a lot from Mark Hawthorne's talk.
So Darren, I'm wondering, who is the conference intended for? Is it only for vegans and ardent animal rights activists?
I think in general, it's very much open to anybody who is interested in animal advocacy. And that's the thing is, A lot of times when we talk about animal advocacy, people have this more sort of a stereotypical idea of like, who is an animal rights activist or animal advocate? What's the kind of actions they do? Are they the people who are out on the street holding a sign, you know, or right. are they handing out leaflets? But I think that this conference alone, just by looking at the diversity of the speakers and their all of their different backgrounds, you know, this is very much showing the general public that animal advocacy is, you know, there's so many different things that you can do. There's so many different people who qualify as an animal advocate. And so I would say it's definitely not just an event that's for people who are already vegan and into animal rights, but for anybody who would like to learn more.
I mean, and in my opinion, I would hope that lots of non-vegans would attend, not necessarily, you know, to convert them or whatever, but to get feedback from the community, because any social justice movements thrives on community building and hearing from community and how we can give back and engage and not just be this theoretical, moral superior movement, but actually engage in the material reality of our surroundings. So hopefully there'll be lots of people attending who aren't necessarily exposed to this information yet.
I think that's always been the main goal of this conference too, since we started it years ago, is to bring people from different facets of animal advocacy, and even those who don't know anything. I always say it's for people who want to learn about animal advocacy, like even if you're not actively in it. Right.
And give feedback too. If you already have ideas about things, to give feedback, because we may not have heard from you or have heard the kind of ideas that are generally outside of our bubbles.
Absolutely.
Darren, what would you say is the general goal for this conference?
Yeah. So actually, this kind of goes back a little bit to the previous question as well, because one thing I did also want to mention was that even though this is a conference that is intended to the general public, I think there's a lot of potential and good that can come out of just bringing together activists who are already so committed and passionate about animal advocacy, but who are currently doing all sorts of different types of work, practicing different strategies and tactics, and have different ideas and experiences, to bring them all together to network with each other and talk, and maybe, you know, there are some possibilities for future collaborations that can come out of a conference like this just by bringing activists together. So that's definitely one of the goals, is to get people to reflect on each other's work and on their own work critically and constructively, as a way to collectively advance the goal of animal rights and animal liberation.
I think the goal of animal rights and animal liberation is going to be more easily achieved if all these little groups that are doing work for the animals all converge together, right? And that's what I like about conferences like this. It's like, this is our chance. And that's why I say it's Vancouver's premier conference on animal advocacy, because it includes everyone. We want it to include everyone. So if you're listening to this and you know, you consider yourself to be an advocate for the animals, whether it's for a group that you volunteer or work for, or just on as an individual, you're just someone who cares about animals and speaking up for them, come to this event.
We
want to make it really accessible too. I was wondering if maybe you could talk about like the low income options. Like, we've tried to make it affordable as it is, but of course, affordable is a sort of, it's a versatile term, right? What's affordable for one isn't for another. So how can I don't want anyone to be turned away from this event. I was really, you know, clear about that when we were organizing options for prices and that. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that, how it's accessible to everyone.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, ideally, if I had my way, I would definitely have wanted to have this as a free conference where anybody can come. But
there are expenses to put this on.
Absolutely, yeah. As I learned,
we've done a lot of fundraising though too.
Yes, yeah. As I've learned, this is the first time that I've taken on sort of a key role in organizing a conference. And as things went on, I realized, damn, there are costs that need to be covered for the conference. But I'm really glad that we are able to come up with this low income option, where basically on the day of the event, anybody can walk in to the event and pay only $10 to attend, and $20 for both days, so $10 each day, and hopefully that will allow more people who can't afford the full price ticket to attend the event.
And it's an accessible venue as well, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, so. The Wise Hall has, you know, wheelchair accessible washrooms. We're going to provide ASL interpreter at the event.
Right. So can you talk about some of the feedback that you've received in the past from animal advocacy camps and the value that people have gained from the previous conferences? I know there has been a lot of positive feedback in the past, which is why I feel that this event is so important for our community here in Vancouver.
Yeah, I think when you bring together a big group of like-minded individuals, we're all there to inspire each other and encourage each other to do more for the betterment of the lives of animals. And we've definitely had many people who attended animal advocacy camps in the past that are currently much more involved and engaged with animal advocacy and are activists themselves now, doing all sorts of different work, whether it's participating in protests or handing out leaflets on the street.
Know of some people who got their start in animal advocacy just from attending one of these conferences.
Yeah, so for sure.
That's cool. Like, you know, people that, you know, you and Beck were all sort of, we know people in the community, and then people just showed up at this conference and they gained connections. They met people, they networked, and they started doing great things for the animals.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Is like a lot of times you're passionate about an issue, but you don't know
how
to start. Yeah, and to see that there is an entire community of people out there who are all interested in the same thing that you are is a really empowering experience.
Right. So now let's talk about the perks, the things that people really care about.
Yay.
Here. Let's talk about the extras. Other than the fantastic lineup of speakers, obviously, we'll be having sponsor tables, food, and an after party. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. Actually, this year we have two caterers for the conference, Eternal Abundance and David Isbister's Plant-Based Food and Natural Products.
Yum.
And actually, Allison, I'm really grateful for Allison, who has been helping out so much in organizing the food aspect of this event. Yes.
So I have the final menu announced for food's included, and it's a great deal. So the final food options for the Saturday, which is being provided by David Isbister. He's a little local caterer. I'll just read a little bit of it. So he's going to be doing some zucchini muffins with coconut butter and a fruit and nut salad. And then a gluten-free raw option will be flax cakes with fruit and nut salad for breakfast. We're providing breakfast and lunch. For lunch, he's got a local complex green salad in smoky cheddar sauce with pickled beets and assorted pickles, handmade cheeses. And that's gluten-free. And then raw option is tomatoes gazpacho, local heirloom. That's a soup with cultured cashew cream. And then for the main, an Indo-Chinese mung bean, cloud fungus, and vegetable stew on brown rice with chopped duck. That's D-U-K cutlets, gluten-free option, marinated sautéed oyster mushrooms, and fudge fingers and raw apple pie squares.
God, I don't know if I can wait a week for that.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Quickly, we're almost out of time here, so I just wanted to quickly say, too, we have a post-conference after party, because I like parties, so I organized the last one before, and it was fun. We all went out to a local restaurant, so I wanted to do that again, so we're offering a great deal for people who want to converge more and to mingle more and network more after the conference and have some fun. We're having a dinner at Pokong Vegetarian Restaurant, 7 p.m. on the Sunday, and I have arranged an all-inclusive menu, so everyone gets 10 items off the menu. So it's a 10-course dinner, basically, or 10-dish dinner for $18. It's tax and tip included. And if you want to go to that, you can just I do have a Facebook event for it. It's on the Vancouver Animal Advocacy Camp Facebook group. But then you can also just sign up on Saturday and pay then. So very quickly, tell us about registration details, and we are closing off the pre-registration tomorrow, right?
Yes. So online registration ends at the end of tomorrow, Saturday, May 14th, and online registration will get you a food ticket at the event. If you're unable to register online for any reason at all, please email, and you would like to register to have a food ticket at the event, please email info@liberationbc.org so we can register your name, and then on the day of the event, you can just pay by cash the regular ticket amount. And once again, for people who would not to who would like to just attend the conference for a cheaper ticket price, a discounted price, you can just walk in on the day of the event and pay $10 for one day or $20 for both days.
And I wanted to announce, too, that we are giving away a free ticket to the event here at Animal Voices. So very quickly, we're going to be doing this draw in 25 minutes. And you're listening live here on Friday, May the 13th. So easy way to enter is just send us an email, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And let us know what you're most looking forward to about the conference. And we'll be doing that draw in 25 minutes. Thank you for telling us all about this year's Animal Advocacy Camp. Darren, it takes place at the Wise Hall from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on May the 21st, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. on May 22nd. To find out more, please visit the conference website at animaladvocacycamp2016.weebly.com.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Okay, so now we have some news for you. So the first news from this week was... it's not really news. It's yet another tragic case of a conservation officer in BC unjustifiably euthanizing and killing a bear cub, which is a really tragic event. And things like this happen every year. We hear about it when human-wildlife conflict occurs or an orphaned wild animal is found and conservation officers decide that it's best to kill them instead of trying to find them a rescue or a home. But what's really interesting about this year's case with this one bear cub that was found close to Smithers, British Columbia, was that a wildlife rescue association has actually spoken out and decided, you know, that, you know, as animal advocates and as people who care about animals in general, we should really think about whether conservation officers should, you know, have the authority to decide which when it is okay to euthanize an animal, or should the decision be made by people who have more expertise in that area, like veterinarians, for example. So that was like an interesting development, I think, in the conversation about wildlife conservation.
Another news story highlights an interesting relationship that artists are starting to have towards animals. There's been a surge in using animals in art exhibits. For example, recently, the artist Duke Riley strapped LED lights to the legs of more than 2,000 birds. He calls it Fly By Night, and it's a show over the East River in New York City. 18 shows are scheduled between May and June, and essentially pigeons are strapped with these lights, and because it is stress-inducing, because it is deorientating for the pigeons, they are, many of them are drowning in the cold water and attempt to return back to the boat. Another artist who uses animals is called Maurizio Catalan, and he put on a show titled Enter at Your Own Risk. Do not touch, do not feed, no smoking, no photographs, no dogs, thank you. That's the entire title. And it features a live donkey in a room lit by a Baroque chandelier. This is at the Fries Art Fair, and it's it was on for 3 days in May. Many animal advocates spoke out against the show because clearly it uses an animal as an object. And even though the intention of the work is to connect humans and animals, that's a quote from Maurizio Catalan, it clearly values sensationalism over material ethics. And I'm disappointed as an artist myself by the Fries Art Fair for allowing this.
It's a little bit odd, I have to say. Both two different art installations, quote-unquote, using animals at the same time. And I'm curious about the first one that you mentioned with the birds, that no one, like, where's the SPCA? Why is no one doing anything about it?
And this is the problem when animals such as pigeons or, for example,
they don't have rights.
Rats are used for humans, because they are already considered outcast sort of pests. Vermin or pests. So it's difficult to speak out for animals like that because, yeah, society doesn't value them in the same way.
Well, thank you for the news.
For our feature interview today, we have Dutch-American ethologist and primatologist Frans de Waal on the show. Frans has authored popular and award-winning books such as Chimpanzee Politics and Peacemaking Among Primates. His scientific articles specialize in animal behavior and cognition, and his latest interests are animal cooperation, emotion, empathy, and the evolution of human morality. Hans is a longtime member of the board of directors of the National Chimpanzee Sanctuary, Chimphaven. He has been elected to both the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and in 2007, he was named by Time magazine as one of the world's 100 most influential people today, and in 2011, by Discover magazine as among 47 all-time great minds of science. Frans is here today to speak about his brand new book entitled, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Hello, Frans, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
I'm happy to be there.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak about your book on the human exploration of animal intelligence. This is a field that you have spent decades in, and you've seen its progression throughout the years. To start, can you talk about the field of ethology versus comparative psychology, and how has the acceptance of its study evolved over the years?
Well, you know, I was trained as an ethologist, which is a European, mostly biological direction. And so ethologists like to look at natural or naturalistic behavior and are interested in what animals do spontaneously in their environment. And then the behaviorists or the comparative psychologists in the U.S., they were more interested in controlling animal behavior, putting them in a box and training them to do certain things and how good were they at this, and how much reward do they need for what they do. And so that was more like a training method, operant conditioning. And so these two schools, both of them, I think, they simplified animal minds by saying it's either instinct what they have or it's simple learning what they have. And they didn't look much beyond animals with small brains like fish and pigeons and rats. They certainly didn't look at chimpanzees or elephants or dolphins. And so they had a very simplistic view of animal intelligence. And we were not even allowed to talk about it. So animal intelligence or animal cognition were sort of taboo terms. We better explain everything in the simplest possible way.
Is it still like that, do you think? Or do you think that the field is evolving so that others in your field and the comparative psychologists, they're starting to recognize that, yeah, animals do have emotions and they have intelligence? Is that starting to change?
Yeah, I think it has changed dramatically. So it is not that the ethologists were wrong or that the behaviorists were wrong. I think there are instincts. And I think there are simple learning processes, and anyone who trains a dog is making use of behaviorist techniques, basically. So they were not wrong, but they were far too simple in their view. And at the moment, we have a new generation of scientists, I would say the last 25 years or so, who's looking at animals in a very different way. So instead of trying to simplify everything or trying to only compare them with humans, and of course we always want to be humans to be the smartest of them all. So instead of focusing on that comparison, they're trying to understand how animals survive in their natural habitat, what kind of adaptations do they have, what kind of intelligence do they have. You cannot expect an octopus to have the same sort of intelligence as let's say an elephant. They live in such different environments and have such a different background that we need to judge each one on their own terms and see what they need in their environment.
Well, your book largely speaks of cognition in animals, that is. What is cognition and how does it compare to, say, instinct or possessing an innate knowledge? What is the difference?
Well, cognition is a term that we use in science as the processing of information. So how do you process information? What do you do with it? How do you make use of it? How do you put it to your own advantage? And so it's information processing, which means that if you have different senses, like a bat has echolocation and has obviously very different senses than we do, you have a different cognition. A bat needs very different cognition than the human, because a bat needs to orient in the dark and to catch prey and do that with echolocation. So obviously the bat needs a lot of brain power to do that, and we call that cognition because it's processing information, but it's not the kind of information that we have. And so cognition is very much tied to what kind of animal you are, whereas intelligence is usually a term that we use for find sort of flexible solutions to problems. And many animals, of course, have intelligence in very different ways.
Well, you look at human cognition as a variety of animal cognition rather than separating the two apart. Why is that?
Well, I think humans are animals. We have always focused on finding uniquely human characteristics. We are very happy to say only humans have theory of mind, or only humans can make tools. There are so many claims, and almost all of these claims have, within 5 or 10 years, they have disappeared from view, because we then found that actually chimpanzees make tools, or that dolphins have complex communication, or whatever. So basically, the quest to find how humans are different has failed, has not worked very well, and that is because our cognition is not fundamentally different from animal cognition. We may have a more powerful computer than they have, but we don't have a different computer. It's essentially the same sort of brain that we have than anyone else.
Well, I'd like to talk about anthropomorphism versus a new term that I learned from your book, and that is anthropodenial. Many of us know that anthropomorphism is the action of ascribing human attributes to a non-human being, but you invented the term anthropodenial. What is this, and why is this term needed?
Yes, because anthropomorphism, there's an excessive fear of anthropomorphism. Now, of course, you have to be careful. If your cat jumps from one chair to another and misses the jump, and you say the cat is embarrassed, I'm not sure that the cat is embarrassed. I'm also not sure that dogs feel guilt. Dogs may anticipate problems when they have done something wrong, but whether they feel guilt. So there's a lot of anthropomorphism that we have to be careful with. But having said that, there's also a lot of things that animals do that is very comparable to what we do. So, for example, animals show empathy for each other. Dogs certainly do. Chimpanzees do. And I don't see a reason to avoid that kind of terminology. And the example that I use is, if you tickle a chimpanzee baby or a chimpanzee juvenile, they have the same tickling spots as human children. They have sounds that are very similar to laughing. They go like type of sound. So they... And their facial expression is like laughing. So we need to call it laughing, because it is basically an animal that is very close to us. And if it shows similar behavior, we need to give it similar terminology. And so I use the term anthropodenial for those who are opposed to that, those who insist that a kiss by a chimpanzee needs to be called mouth-to-mouth contact, because we should avoid terms like a kiss. But I don't think we need to avoid that if the behavior is so similar and used so similarly. And so people who insist on these differences and try to drive a wedge between us and other species, I call that anthropodenial. They're sort of denying the connection that we have with other species.
Well, I'd like to move on to examples that you use in your book to explore animal intelligence. You write about face recognition, which I think was once thought was a skill that only humans possessed. However, this couldn't be further from the truth. There have been many documented cases of animals such as crows, sheep, and even wasps being able to recognize faces, and even human faces at that. Can you tell us about some of these findings?
Yeah, the first studies on face recognition that were done on animals were done on chimpanzees, and the conclusion was that chimpanzees don't have it. And so the conclusion automatically became humans are the only ones who recognize faces very easily, which is a strange conclusion, because chimpanzee faces, as we all know who work with chimps, they're just as different as human faces. So that was a sort of strange idea. And then it was found that all these studies on chimpanzees had been done with human pictures. So the chimp is put in front of a touch screen and shown human faces, and they're just not particularly good at human faces. And it's only when we started testing them on chimp faces that it turned out that they were just as good at it as humans were. And now we know the same thing actually for monkeys and not just chimpanzees. And actually we also know now from studies that the same brain areas are involved in human face recognition and chimpanzee face recognition. And so it's basically the same process. And after that, people found face recognition in sheep. You know, you wouldn't think that. Sheep do look alike to us, but sheep are very good at face recognition of each other. And then more recently, even there's a wasp study. So these are paper wasps that live in small societies with a strict hierarchy of A, B, C, D, of females, rank order among the females. And they're very good at recognizing faces. They have different yellow patches, yellow and black patches in the face. And they're very good at face recognition. And so now face recognition has spread all the way to the wasps.
Yeah, that's incredible. I certainly hadn't known about the wasps before. Now, you have a section in your book about language acquisition by animals, and this is particularly fascinating to me because I've always wanted to be able to talk to the animals, and we've achieved this in some capacities. Can you tell us your thoughts about the progress that has been made by humans in communicating with animals and teaching them our language, such as with Alex, the African gray parrot?
Yeah, so there's a sort of mixed message here about language acquisition by animals is that Alex the parrot is truly remarkable and is very well documented, but calling it language, people are sort of reluctant to do, and I'm reluctant to do, because Alex can pronounce words and associate them with certain objects. There's no problem with that. He's very good at symbolic communication, but to string these words together into real sentences in a sort of flexible, syntactical way we humans do, I don't think Alex is particularly good at it, and none of the apes is particularly good at it. And so there's a whole debate on whether we should call it language or not. I think that the real comparisons with language that we're going to find is in the natural communication of animals. They don't have symbolic communication like we do, but they are certainly able to convey very complex messages to each other and to express their emotions to each other. But people have been trying that, and sort of these language studies on apes and the parrots, they're sort of over the hill. They are very useful to get at the general cognition of these animals, and that has been proven extremely useful. But whether they measure language, there's a lot of doubt about that.
Well, let's talk about consciousness in animals. What defines a larger consciousness between one species and another, if such a measurement exists? Is it the larger brain, the more consciousness that being possesses?
Yeah, the consciousness debate is also complex, and I talk about that in the book, is that I don't know exactly what consciousness is, and most philosophers, most scientists, we don't know exactly what it is. But having said that, there are certain things that we humans find very difficult to do without being conscious of it. So, for example, if you plan for the future, you plan a party in a week or something, you have to be conscious of the planning. You cannot do that unconsciously. We deliberately plan things. Or if you try to know whether you know something, I asked you a question and you think you know the answer. Knowing what you know is a conscious process. And so we're increasingly testing these things in animals, and we're finding them in animals. And as a result, we say that, well, if we humans, we plan ahead by being conscious about it, how can a chimpanzee plan, because chimpanzees plan for the future, how can they do that without being conscious about it? So they have to have some degree of consciousness. So let me give you an example how chimps do this, or bonobos. In this case, it's a bonobo. It's we had a bonobo, Lizala, at the place where we worked, who picked up a very heavy rock, like 15 pounds, put it on her back, and started walking. And she started walking and walking, and she walked like half a kilometer, so very long distance. And then she came to a place where she picked up some very hard nuts, and then she continued walking and walking and walking until she came to the only place in the whole forest there where there's a hard surface. And she puts down her rock, and she puts down her nuts, and she starts cracking those nuts with the rock. Now, this means that she picked up her tool about 15 minutes before she even had nuts in her hand. And then she probably knew where these nuts could be found, and then she went another 15 minutes to the place where she could crack these things. And that's what we mean by planning. That requires that you have a plan, that you pick up a rock not for no reason, but for a particular reason. And we humans, we cannot do these things without being conscious. So why would we assume that the bonobo is doing this in a sort of unconscious manner? That doesn't make a lot of sense.
And what is the correlation between you wrote about this a bit in your book about brain size and consciousness. Now, I learned from your book that our brain is 1.35 kilograms. So are those with larger brains than us, such as elephants and whales, more conscious than we are?
Well, that's a very good question. So I attended a lecture by a famous philosopher who was saying consciousness obviously arises from the connections between neurons, which means that it is a sort of a product of connectivity. And he kept talking like that, and he was absolutely convinced that humans had by far the most consciousness of any species. But, you know, there are species with brains bigger than us. And there's even a species, the elephant, has three times more neurons than us. We know that now. Since the last 2 years, we have a lot of evidence on the elephant. So if it is a matter of connectivity, as this philosopher was claiming, why would we then not conclude that the elephant is maybe more conscious than us? Not that I'm saying that that's the case, because I personally don't know exactly what consciousness is. But if you look at it as that kind of product, you have to draw the consequences of that.
Well, why is it so difficult on a large scale, do you think, for humans to recognize the intelligence capacities of other species of animals? And do you think that that degrades our own level of intelligence to not even make these realizations?
Yeah, the book is a lot about the resistance, the historical resistance that we scientists had to fight against. You don't find that very much among the average. If you ask the average man in the street, is your dog intelligent? Does your dog have feelings? I don't think you're going to find anyone who denies these things. But in science, funny enough, there were a lot of people who were very skeptical about these things. And so there has been an enormous resistance, which partly I think is a religious resistance, like we have souls and animals don't have souls. So there has been this tendency to set ourselves apart. And this has maybe also been a sort of moral resistance. The way we treat animals is not always nice, as you probably know. And maybe this was a way of justifying how we treat them by downplaying their intelligence and their emotions. And so the sort of work that I describe in the book, the new science of, let's say, animal cognition, really is going to have moral implications as well.
Well, you say that the field of ethology has evolved to a point where every species has a different cognitive story to tell. What do you mean by that? And what can we humans learn from animal intelligence?
Yeah, so since cognition is tied to the senses, so cognition is not independent. So if you are an echolocating bat and you fly around in the dark and you need to catch your prey with echolocation, you need an enormous amount of brain power that goes into that particular process, which is not something we humans can relate to because we don't do anything like it. So the bat has a very different cognition than ours. It's not better, it's not worse. That kind of comparisons we don't make. Who's the smarter of the two? It's more like, how is your cognition adapted to what you need to do? We are basically primates. So we're very good at three-dimensional space, and we have hands that can grasp branches and climb around. Now, we don't do a lot of climbing anymore, but we come from this group of animals that climbed around in trees, and that's why we have binocular vision and everything. So that's very important to us, but there's other species that have totally different requirements, like the elephant or the octopus or the bat, and it's very hard for us to relate to their cognition because it's so different from ours.
Well, in your book, you say that neuroscience has only thus far just scratched the surface in exploring these cognitive abilities. What do you think lies in the future of this field of study?
Oh, I think neuroscience is going to play a big role. So neuroscience until now is more what we call descriptive and is not particularly useful in solving issues of animal intelligence, but it's going to happen. We know, for example, already that face recognition in humans and monkeys and sheep activates the same areas in the brain. And so these processes are probably very much related to each other. Whereas, for example, something like tool use in the crows and tool use in the chimpanzees is maybe not so related to each other. Because after all, birds and primates are quite distinct branches on the evolutionary tree. And so they probably use very different neural processes to get there. And I think neuroscience is going to help resolve a lot of these issues in the future.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Franz, to speak about your new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? I encourage our listeners to check out this book if you want to know more about this field. Thank you so much and have a great day.
You're welcome.
So we are going to do the draw now for a free ticket for next weekend's Vancouver Animal Advocacy Camp. It's Vancouver's premier annual conference on animal advocacy issues. And this ticket is worth $60. That's the price to attend for the weekend and includes all of your meals. And I have done the draw. And the winner is, I'm pleased to announce, it's Lane Powell. So congratulations, Lane. And we'll be in contact soon to let you know how you can claim your ticket. I guess.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm so glad that Lane won. So, yeah, looking forward to that. And remember, for everyone else who's interested in advocating for the animals, to come to next week's Animal Advocacy Camp, you can go to It's the Animal Advocacy Camp 2016.weebly.com, and the pre-registration closes off tomorrow, but you're also welcome to register at the door next week at the Wise Hall. Starts on Saturday at 9 a.m.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, May the 20th, and it's a surprise show.
I love surprises.
Surprise, surprise. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts. You can read our blog, show blog with detailed links, and subscribe to the show via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're closing the show now with a song, If I Could Talk to the Animals, by Bobby Darin. Stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
If I could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be. If we could talk to the animals, learn all their languages, maybe take an animal degree. I'd study elephant and eagle, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig, and flea. I would converse in polar bear and python, and I would curse in fluent kangaroo. If people asked me, can you speak rhinoceros? I'd say, of carceros, can't you? If I conferred with our furry friends, man to animal, think of the amazing repartee. If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt and squeak and squawk with the animals, and they could talk to me. If I consulted with quadrupeds, think what fun we'd have asking over crocodiles for tea. Or maybe lunch with two or three lions, walruses and sea lions. What a lovely place the world would be. If I spoke slang to orangutans, the advantages why any fool on earth could plainly see. Discussing Eastern art and dramas with intellectual llamas, that's a big step forward, you'll agree. I'd learn to speak in antelope and turtle, and my Pekingese would be extremely good. If I were asked to sing in hippopotamus, I'd say winotamus, and I would. If I could parlay with pachyderms, it's a fairy tale worthy of Hans Andersen and Grimm. A man who walks with the animals and talks with the animals, grunts and squeaks and squawks with the animals, and they could talk to him. Let me hear him talk.
study every creature's language so I could speak to all of them on sight. If friends said, can he talk in crab or maybe pelican, you'd say like hell he can, and you'd be right. And if you just stop and think of it, ain't no doubt of it, I'm gonna win a place in history. If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt, squeak, squawk with the animals, and they could squeak and squawk and speak.